is boring, dull, tedious, and frankly uninteresting. Anyone can pack a suitcase, but only the brave set sail, as Agatha Swanburn also said. Truly, the wise founder had a pithy saying for most, if not all, occasions. During these same 3 days, however, events elsewhere, that is to say, in England, on the estate of the notoriously wealthy, hopelessly nearsighted, and increasingly worked-up father-to-be, Lord Frederick Ashton, were as far from uninteresting as the frozen tundra of Siberia is from the balmy beaches of the Black Sea. Fortunately for us, and unlike Miss Penelope Lumley, we can return to Ashton Place simply by reading about it, and so we shall. Thanks to the tireless efforts of Mrs. Clark, the baby's room is nearly finished, and surely that is well worth a look.
Hold on now, I've almost got it! There!
Mrs. Clark was not a small woman, nor a young one, but she scurried down the ladder as nimbly as a squirrel. After several tries, the painting she had been trying to hang on the wall was now perfectly centred between the windows of the sunny bedchamber that was being readied for the new baby. She gazed at her achievement with satisfaction, hands planted solidly on hips.
A bit of art is just what the room needed. As our dear Miss Lumley would say, it's never too soon to begin a child's education. That picture of yours is a perfect example of... What did you say the star was again, dear?
Ominous landscape, Beowulf explained. But not too ominous. Baby ominous.
It was true. If the baby ominous landscape style of painting had not previously existed, Beowulf had surely invented it now. The painting he made, especially for the barking baby Ashton's room, portrayed a dense wood, but not a spooky one, as broad beams of yellow sliced through the trees to make cheery patches of sunlight on the mossy forest floor. Animal eyes glinted from the shadows, but they were the eyes of friendly bunnies. The birds perched in the trees were not vultures, but gentle cooing doves with a few comically roosting chickens mixed among them. As for the figures who occupied the foreground of the work, well, yes, they were wolves, but they were happy, gentle wolves, and featured a mama wolf tenderly playing with her cubs. Overall, a perfect balance of light and shadow had been struck. One could say the painting had gravitas, but not gloom. Gravitas, gravity, and even the word grave all come from the Latin word gravis, which means heavy. If something has gravitas, that means it is serious and possesses dignity. Beowulf was the sort of artist who liked to put a bit of gravitas in his work, but he knew that a painting for a baby's room ought not to cause bad dreams either. As you see, his present for the baby was both handmade and chosen with the recipient in mind, which is the best kind of present there is. Mrs. Clark propped the ladder by the door.
It's lovely, dear. I can't imagine the baby not liking that picture, especially since it's from one of his...
But her words tapered off. For what relation were the incorrigible children to the new baby, exactly? Obviously, they were not siblings. Companions? Housemates?
Fellow children, she concluded. It's a gift from one of his fellow children, and that will surely please him. And look how perfectly it matches the wallpaper.
As she had nervously explained to Lord Frederick and his haggard houseguest just the other day, she had chosen a nature theme for the baby's room. Lord Frederick had quite a chuckle over it.
Nature, quite right. As if the child were napping in the woodsy woods among the wild animals. What? Ha ha!
The wallpaper was a leaf pattern in a pale green, and the ceiling had been painted a bright sky blue, with loopy clouds in shades of white floating here and there. The crib itself was an elaborate wicker swinging cradle that squeaked when it rocked. Cassiopeia could not resist giving it a push every now and then, so she could listen to the way the squeaking slowed and faded as the crib stopped moving. She did it once more.
Squeak! 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 Squeak!
Oil can, Alexander suggested.
Mrs. Clark shook her head.
Best leave it be. That's the same crib his lordship slept in as a baby. We never fix a squeak because it meant a person could hear when the little scamp was climbing out in the middle of the night, as he liked to do every so often.
Sure he did. Every 4 weeks on the night of the full moon.
Old Timothy leaned in the doorway, hands shoved deep in his pockets. He had carried the ladder upstairs and was waiting to take it away when Mrs. Clark was done with it.
No need to mince words, Mrs. Clark. Young Freddy was a, well, unusual child, and that's the truth.
Mrs. Clark gave her apron an irritated tug.
I'm not mincing words, you strange old man. I'm minding my own business, and you should mind yours.
The enigmatic coachman jerked his head in the direction of the incorrigibles.
It's too late for keeping secrets, Nell. As if these three cubs didn't know how stirred up the moon can make a person feel. Wild and lonesome inside, and restless as the wind, till the only thing to do is throw back your head and let loose. Ow!
He crooned a long, soft howl, so wolf-like it made the skin on the backs of the children's necks prickle.
And soon we'll have a wee little moonstruck Ashton on the premises. Imagine that. Let's hope he's not the last of the line.
What a thing to say about a child who's not even born.
Mrs. Clark placed a pile of clean folded blankets in the crib, jostling it.
Squeak! Squeak!
Was the noise it made as it rocked from side to side.
Squeak! Squeak!
Poor lamb, she murmured, as if the baby were already in there, nestled among the blankets.
He'll be an odd one, if the past is any guide. Oh, there it is again.
Her eyes widened and her shoulders drew back sharply.
It's like a sliver of ice rubbed down my spine. It's been happening nearly every day lately, just like when Mr. Clark passed. For weeks afterward, I'll be going about my business in a sad fog. Then all at once, I'll get the strangest notion he was standing just behind me, looking over my shoulder. I'd spin around to see, but there'd be nothing, nothing at all, and then I'd get that same icy shiver like I just had now.
Sounds like ghosties,
Cassiopeia said, unafraid. The housekeeper flinched.
In a baby's room? I hope not.
She stilled the crib with a hand, as if it might move again of its own accord.
Then again, who knows what sort of mischief goes on beyond the veil? I'd like to think we just shimmer out of our old, worn-out bodies and float calmly to the realm invisible when our time comes. But perhaps that's not always the case.
Old Timothy snorted.
I'll say, there's a world of difference between being dead and being at rest.
Oh, Hamlet, what a falling off was there,
Alexander proclaimed. His siblings nodded in agreement. Hamlet was one of the better ghost stories they knew. Mrs. Clark turned to the coachman and wagged a finger.
Now, don't you say anything else, frightening old Tim. You've got the children spouting nonsense. I'll barely sleep tonight as it is, after all this talk of you-know-what.
Beowulf cocked his head to one side.
Shakespeare?
Rhymes with toasties, my boy. I'd rather not speak the word again.
Mrs. Clark began folding the basket of cloth diapers and, comically, miniature baby clothes she had brought to fill the dresser drawers.
Lord knows, a new baby ought to be a joyful occasion, but this icy shiver of mine leaves the most peculiar feeling when it's gone, like something dreadful is on its way, like time is running out.
Her voice dropped, as if she were speaking mostly to herself.
I haven't felt right since Miss Lumley's been gone. That's the truth of it. This big old house isn't the same as when she was here, dancing through the halls, pilfering books from the library and spouting words of wisdom from that school of hers. Poor thing. Poor Miss Lumley. I hope she's all right.
The incorrigibles looked grave. Cassiopeia emitted a small, high whimper that made Mrs. Clark remember where she was.
Whoops, silly me, running off at the mouth. Of course she's all right. There's no one more brave and clever than our Lummerwoo. Is there, children? I'm sure she's managing just fine.
She grabbed one of the clean cloth diapers and used it to blow her nose. The children ran to console her, though they could have used some consoling themselves. Old Timothy rolled his eyes.
"Enough, belly aching. There's work to be done," he grumbled.
He tipped the ladder sideways and edged it through the door. As he did, Lord Frederick and his wife turned the corner at the end of the hall.
"Don't fret, my dear. The advertisement will be in Thursday's paper. I'm sure we'll have dozens of ladies to choose from," he said as they approached. "One of them's bound to be suitable. Whoops, easy there, Tim. Mind your ladder, unless you want to try your hand at a bit of jousting."
Lord Frederick chuckled and played at jousting for a moment.
"Awfully medieval jousting. A man could get hurt. I'll stick to billiards, what?"
Old Timothy grunted enigmatically and propped the ladder in the hall. Lady Constance paid him no mind as she sailed into the room.
"Suitable is not good enough, Frederick. The baby nurse must be perfect. Strict, but not too strict. Kind, but not too kind. It is far too easy to spoil a child with affection. One must beware. Eek!"
The lady's shriek was so sharp and sudden that everyone looked down to see if a wee mousie was scurrying about. But her round, doll-like eyes were fixed on the incorrigibles.
"The wolf children! What are they doing in here?"
Alexander snapped a salute. His two siblings did likewise.
"Baby room inspection service reporting for duty, your noble ladiness," he said. "This room has been deemed acceptable for the young heir-to-be."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Beowulf added. He and his brother clicked their heels together for emphasis. It was a habit they had picked up from Captain Babushkinov. The children's memories of their former friends in Plinks were bittersweet at best, heart-rending at worst, but the heel-clicking gesture was both invigorating and enjoyable, and they saw no reason to give it up.
"You are very big, Lady Globe."
Cassiopeia curtsied and spread both arms wide, as if to embrace the earth itself.
"Lady Globe?"
Lady Constance's expression soured.
"Does she mean I look like some sort of planet?"
Mrs. Clark stammered an explanation while the children volunteered to name all the planets, but Lord Frederick interjected.
"Nonsense, dear. You're sleek as a racehorse. I'd never believe you were with child if Dr. Weltschmerz hadn't said so."
That made his wife beam. She perched her hands on either side of her enormous middle as if showing off a tiny wasp waist.
"It's true that we Barbies are known for never losing our figures. And I am still wearing all my favourite dresses, so it must be so."
As you may recall, Miss Constance Barbie had been her name before she married Lord Frederick. However, the seamstress Madame Lepont had been letting out all of Lady Constance's dresses for months, and the lady was none the wiser.
"I hope you like how the room's coming along, my lady," Mrs. Clark said, for she was rightly proud of it. "It's not finished, of course, but we're getting closer by the day. Why, I've already put some diapers in the drawers." "Diapers!"
Lady Constance shivered in distaste.
"What an awful word! I hope I shall not have to hear it again."
She walked around the room inspecting.
"I am not convinced about this wallpaper, Mrs. Clark. It is very leafy."
"It's symbolic,"
Beowulf offered.
"It symbolizes leaves."
"Leaves, yes."
Lady Constance chose a book from a small bookshelf that had been placed beneath the window.
"Giddy-up rainbow,"
she read and confidently declared.
"This story is about a pony. I can tell from the picture of the pony on the cover. But babies cannot read," she frowned. "Can they?"
"Not at first, my lady," Mrs. Clark explained. "But even very young children like being read to.
Our own Miss Lumley taught me that."
It was Mrs. Clark who had placed these books in the baby's room, for, as previously mentioned, she had grown fond of the giddy-yap rainbow tales. She sometimes read them aloud with great feeling when she was alone in her room, between bites of licorice. If caught, doubtless, she would have blushed and said it was just practice for reading to the children, and that may have been true in part, but mostly she did it because she liked to. She liked saying the words and hearing them, and she liked imagining herself a plump, widowed housekeeper with more of life behind her than ahead, as a wide-eyed young girl astride her first pony, learning to ride and having adventures and growing up all over again. It was like having a time machine and a fountain of youth rolled into one, and all between hard covers. Next, Lady Constance stopped in front of Beowulf's painting.
"What a strange picture," she said. "It is gloomy, but not entirely so. One might say it is both gloomy and cheerful. But oh my! Wolves! That will never do. It ought to show a bowl of fruit, or a queen with a dog in her lap, or some cut flowers waiting to be put in vases. Isn't that what the best paintings have in them?"
Beowulf growled, just loud enough for his siblings to hear. This was quite out of character for a well-mannered, incorrigible, but not entirely out of character for an artist whose work has been so rudely unappreciated. Alexander pinched his brother's arm in warning, and the younger boy covered his mistake with a bit of theatrical throat-clearing. But Cassiopeia could not resist defending her brother.
"It's art, you big globe,"
she said to the lady, none too respectfully. Lady Constance looked around. Suspicious.
"Symbolic wallpaper? Books and art? What sort of a baby's room is this?"
"Well, it's not quite finished yet, as I said. And this painting is a present for the baby, isn't it, Beowulf, dear? All three of the children made presents for the baby. Isn't that lovely?"
Mrs. Clark said, trying makepeace. Judging by the look on her face, Lady Constance remained unconvinced. It was true that the incorrigibles had made presents. They were generous by nature, but in this case their motives were complex. Frankly, there was something nerve-wracking about not knowing how the burping, crying, diaper-wetting new arrival might change things at Ashton Place. This is a perfectly ordinary way to feel about the arrival of new babies, of course. In such situations, kindness is all that is truly required, but a present couldn't hurt, as Agatha Swanburne had often advised. In that spirit, Beowulf had made his painting, and Alexander had built a clever toy called a kaleidoscope. It was made from one of those newfangled telegraph tubes that the postman had given him as a curiosity, with some bits of broken mirror and a handful of sequins and sparkly beads cadged from Madame Lepont. After a nudge from Mrs. Clark, Alexander now offered his kaleidoscope, but Lady Constance waved it away without even looking at the glorious display within. Cassiopeia had had a harder time thinking of a gift. She herself would not have minded having a rocking horse, but a rocking horse was not a good gift for a baby who could not yet sit up in the saddle. She thought of carving a teething ring out of wood, but the baby would not have teeth for a while either. Stumped, she had asked the young housemaid, Margaret, for advice about what babies did for fun. But the girl only laughed her squealing, high-pitched laugh and said,
"No babies don't do much of anything, love. They sleep and eat and cry and mess their diapers. And believe me, that's enough."
Cassiopeia found this answer unhelpful. In the end, she had made a hand-stitched pillow. It was a baby-sized pillow, too small for even a pithy nugget of wisdom, so she had settled on a simple greeting.
"Go ahead, dear,"
Mrs. Clark spoke in that overly sweet, up-and-down, sing-song tone grown-ups sometimes use to steer children past awkward moments.
"Show her ladyship the pretty present you made for the baby. Why, you sewed it all with your own sweet hands, didn't you, dear?"
With a distinct lack of enthusiasm, Cassiopeia showed Lady Constance the pillow she had made.
"Her woo, baby," Lady Constance read. "What on earth does that mean?"
"Her woo,"
Cassiopeia explained with infinite patience.
"What you say when you meet someone."
"Her woo,"
Lady Constance spun around to face her husband. If her globe-shaped tummy had been a real globe, she would have gone from sunrise to sunset just like that.
"Did you hear that, Frederick? Her woo!"
Her voice dropped to a loud whisper, which everyone could hear.
"I told you these howling wolf children ought to be sent away. Imagine what sort of influence they might be!"
Now, Cassiopeia was a bright and hard-working student. She could multiply fractions, turn a cartwheel, and recite entire stanzas of The Wreck of the Hesperus, a marvellous poem about a shipwreck by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. However, when it came to spelling, her own name was so difficult to get right that she had given up on the subject altogether. Her hand-stitched ha-woo had not been intended as a howl at all, but was merely her way of writing hello, so that the word would sound the way she liked to say it. The professional educators among you will note that Cassiopeia had unwittingly invented what would later be called phonetics, a boon to teachers and students to this very day.
"Not ah-woo," she protested. "Hello!"
Her brothers understood perfectly and tried to clarify by alternating a howling ah-woo with a friendly
"Hello!" "Ah-woo! Hello!"
they demonstrated.
"Ah-woo! Ah-woo! 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 Ah-woo!"
Lady Constance turned pale and pressed her hands to her ears.
"Wild, untamed creatures! Now I cannot hear myself think. Not that I much care for thinking."
She moved her hands to her belly as if trying to cover the baby's ears.
"Do not listen, little future person. Behaving like a wild animal is all very well for your father's wolfish wards, but it will never do for the heir to this great estate."
Lord Frederick's good humour seemed to leave him all at once.
"All right, you three, that's quite enough of that,"
he said sharply. Like well-trained cadets, the children instantly stopped making noise and pressed their lips shut in three straight lines. Lady Constance looked smug.
"Much better. Frederick, let us go. I wish to finish our walk. Have a chocolate and then lie down and perhaps have another chocolate while I am lying down. That would settle my nerves perfectly. Dr. Weltschmerz would surely approve."
"Mrs. Clark, have some chocolate brought to my wife's chambers," Lord Frederick commanded.
Mrs. Clark jogged to ring the bell pull, but Lord Frederick interrupted her by adding,
"Do it in person, please."
"As you wish, sir,"
she said with a worried glance at the children. "I'll go to the kitchen and see to it myself." Reluctantly, she left. The mere promise of chocolate had already done wonders for Lady Constance's mood. Expectantly, she slipped her arm through her husband's, but Lord Frederick turned to the door.
"Timothy, are you still there? Don't pretend otherwise. I know how you like to eavesdrop."
The old fellow appeared in the doorway.
"I was just waiting until the missus was done with the ladder," he explained gruffly. "Never mind about the ladder. Take Constance to finish her walk, if you please."
"Aren't you coming, Frederick?" she exclaimed.
"In a moment, dear."
Gently, Lord Frederick steered her toward the door.
"I'd like to have a closer look at this wallpaper. You might be right. The symbolism could be a bit much for a baby. I'll catch up with you and old Tim shortly. We'll have some chocolate together. How's that, what?"
Before she could form a reply, her arm had been smoothly transferred to the coachman's.
"This way, my lady."
Old Timothy's voice took on an irresistible cooing tone.
"We'll have a nice walk, we will. Come along now."
Lady Constance was easily persuaded as a rule, but the soothing sound of old Timothy's voice could make even the most high-strung horse step calmly into rushing stream. Obediently, she went with him down the hall.
"What an enigmatic fellow you are, old Timothy," she remarked, cheerful once again. "I sometimes wonder about you, you know. I wonder what you must have been like as a child, and whether you have ever been in love, or made and lost a great fortune, or travelled to distant lands."
"Distant lands, my, my,"
he cooed as they walked. She laughed.
"Well, there must be more to you than simply being our coachman. But don't tell me, please. It is ever so much more entertaining not to know, and how tedious it is to listen to stories about other people. Honestly, they put me right to sleep."
Lord Frederick waited until his wife's prattling voice had turned the corner. Frowning, he gave the antique crib a sharp push.
"Squeak! Squeak!"
"Still squeaks. Imagine that," he remarked. "I'll have to tell old Timothy to get it fixed. Or I suppose I could find someone to fix it. A blast. I'll just take an oil can to it myself."
He turned to the incorrigibles, who stood in a line as if awaiting inspection.
"Now, listen up, you three," he said. "I know you mean well, but I won't have you reading books and painting pictures and making clever presents for the baby. That will never do."
Shock and disappointment was written on all three faces, for had they not tried their very best to be welcoming to the new baby?
"But why not?"
Alexander mustered the courage to ask.
"It's much too civilized," Lord Frederick shook his head. "What I need for you to do is to bark and howl as much as you can."
The children were flummoxed.
"But not around the baby,"
Beowulf asked, trying hard to understand. Lord Frederick dropped down to his knees so he could speak to the boy face to face.
"No, I mean, yes, howl around the baby. Especially around the baby. You must carry on like wild cubs, just as if you were trying to teach the baby to yap and bay at the moon."
Cassiopeia tugged on Lord Frederick's sleeve.
"Lodaroo, wait. You want us to act like wolves around the baby?"
"Precisely, little girl."
He gave her an awkward pat on the head.
"That's your job, and a very important responsibility it is too. I need you three to wolfy up the baby."
He smiled the rubbery, doggish Ashton smile that all the men in his family shared, wide and toothy, with the canine teeth on full display.
"Don't be shy about it. I know you've got it in you."
The incorrigibles batted at their ears in puppyish disbelief, an old habit that only popped up at moments of extreme confusion.
"Excuse me, Lordship, sir,"
Alexander said, after giving his head a shake.
"So you want the baby to woof?"
"I do indeed. To woof and bark and howl and scratch, like a proper little Ashton should."
Lord Frederick rubbed his hands together.
"This way, when the full moon comes and the baby starts to act like a pup, Constance will think it's because of you three. She'll never suspect there's anything, well, unusual about the baby, and that's how it's going to stay."
"So she'll be mad at us?"
Cassiopeia declared solemnly.
"She is already mad at us,"
Beowulf corrected.
"She will be madder. Mad, madder, maddest,"
Alexander offered. The incorrigibles had been studying comparatives and superlatives. This was no thanks to Master Gogolev, who was not only lazy, but lazier than most tutors. In fact, he was the laziest tutor imaginable. If you ponder that for a moment, you will know all you need to know about comparatives and superlatives. This ought to make you quite proud, or at least prouder than your friends, or possibly the proudest member of your entire family. Lord Frederick nodded.
"She'll complain, no question. But never mind about that. I'll handle Constance. She has a good heart, really. You three just keep doing your job."
"But we already learned not to be woofy,"
Cassiopeia insisted, for she had worked particularly hard at this and had not quite mastered it yet either.
"From Lumawoo."
"Lumawoo, yes. Talk like that. Put your little awoos everywhere. Wolfy it up, that's the spirit. It'll be our secret game, and I expect the baby will be extra clever and catch on right away, no doubt by the very first full moon."
He stood up again with a grunt. One might almost say he looked cheerful, or at least relieved.
"That's all. I'm relying on you three. Remember that."
Lord Frederick's instructions to woofy up the baby puzzled the incorrigibles at first, for of course Lumawoo had gone to great pains to teach them to be less woofy, not more. There had been much practice, a squirrel desensitization program, and many tasty treats employed to this end, and it seemed a giant step backward to give it all up now, after so much time and hard work. But then they remembered that Penelope had also taught them the meaning of irony, and that made the situation perfectly clear. If you had forgotten irony, it was when what happens is the opposite of what one has been led to expect will happen. When people say the opposite of what they truly mean, that too is irony, and there is a special kind of irony called dramatic irony, which is when the audience of a play knows more than the characters on stage do. For example, you know far more than Lord Frederick does about the curse upon the Ashtons, for he thinks it is merely going to make his baby embarrassingly wolfish during the full moon. Alas, the truth was much more dire, a fact that had been concealed from him his whole life by that impostor of a houseguest who was even now sleeping the sleep of the dead in the Egyptian room, a lavish guest room on the far side of the house. As soon as Lord Frederick left, the Incorrigibles made a beeline back to the nursery. Woofy up the baby, Alexander wrote on the to-do-a-woo list. All three children gazed thoughtfully out the window, past the branches of the elm to the dark forest below. Alexander turned to his siblings.
Do you remember how to act wolfish?
I think so,
Beowulf said uncertainly.
I do. I can give lessons.
Cassiopeia growled fiercely and showed her teeth to prove her point. Truth be told, she had always been the wildest of the three. Now she seemed ready to plunge wholeheartedly into her former ways. Her brothers did not feel lessons would be necessary, but thanked her sincerely for the offer. She dropped to all fours and scampered along the floor, just as she used to. She stopped and sat on her haunches, her head cocked to the side.
How wolfish should we be?
She wondered aloud.
Maximum mayhem, or just barky?
Alexander considered the question.
Medium barky to start, he decided. We can always adjust.
Beowulf gnawed anxiously on the back of his chair.
Can I still make paintings? He asked.
It was a reasonable question, as even highly unusual wolves did not typically paint. Yet Beowulf was dedicated to his art, and would be heartbroken to give it up, even temporarily. Alexander gave his brother a reassuring swipe of his paw, that is to say, hand.
You may paint, but wolfishly, he said.
In that instant, the wolfish school of painting was born. Critics still marvel at this brief but dramatic swerve in the history of portraiture. Why a few painters in a remote part of England would suddenly decide to depict their subjects with long noses, rough whiskers around the muzzle, tapered ears, and long pointed canine teeth, all rendered in a confident but childlike hand, has been a mystery that art historians have long tried to solve. The children continued to discuss how to best go about returning to their old habits, and pondered the ethical dilemmas that might pop up. On one point they were in firm agreement. They would happily howl at the moon, chew on expensive leather shoes, climb the furniture, and wreak havoc in any number of wolfish ways, but under no circumstances would they go back to hunting squirrels. Nutsawoo was a twitchy little scamp, and a bushy-tailed menace, and, unbeknownst to the children, a soon-to-be parent, another fine example of dramatic irony. But the dim-witted rodent was simply not a potential meal. The fifth chapter. The capital of Russia is St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg. Back in Plinkst, the packing was nearly finished. The trip to St. Petersburg was happening. Would happen. Must happen. The sheer unlikeliness of receiving such an unexpected invitation was mentioned by no one. Even Veronica had the sense not to repeat her plaintive question.
I wonder how they heard of me.
Not that it would have mattered. The Babushkinovs were in the grip of a kind of faulty logic that psychologists nowadays call confirmation bias. But that the rest of us might simply think of as being Babushkinov through and through, when new facts threatened to upend their opinions, they simply chose to believe what they wished was true and ignored all evidence to the contrary. For really, what were the odds of finding a letter from the Tsar's own ballet company lying on the doorstep? Such an obvious trick would not have worked on most people, but as Edward Ashton himself observed, to know one's prey was essential, and Penelope knew the Babushkinovs. She had gambled on the family's foolishness and self-delusion, and she had won by a length, as they say at the Derby. Or so she believed. There were two members of the household who had their doubts about the letter. One was the Princess Popkinova. The evening before the family's departure, the ancient woman sat in her wheelchair in a dim corner of the drawing room, watching through half-closed eyes as the family quarrelled. A blanket of exquisitely soft fur, an ink-black sable, was wrapped around her shoulders, and another, just like it, was tucked around her legs. In the shadows, she looked like a disembodied head.
"Saint Petersburg," the old woman said.
She drew the word out with profound sarcasm, a tone that requires no translation.
"Saint Petersburg."
One crooked finger emerged from the sable folds and waggled from side to side, as if it were too much trouble for the princess to actually shake her head in disbelief. No one paid attention. They were too busy arguing about whose possessions would go in which trunk, whether it was necessary to tip the driver, who would sit in the front of the troika, and who in the back, and so on. There was a great to-do about leaving baby Max, for the captain flatly refused to hire a nurse to come along on such a long and expensive trip, and Svetlana had far too much work to do at the house. Madame pretended to be heartbroken, but she had no interest in caring for the child either, and so the boy would have to stay home. He screamed till he was red in his little round face, though he could hardly have understood what the fuss was about. The princess waggled her finger.
"Saint Petersburg! Saint Petersburg!"
With each exclamation, it was as if she was saying,
"Are you all complete idiots? What a fool would believe that my simpering granddaughter would attract the attention of the greatest ballet company in the world. She is an overdressed country bumpkin, a spoiled child, and a mediocre dancer at best. If she dares put one smelly toe-shoe in St. Petersburg, she will end up a laughingstock, nothing more."
But all the old woman said, or needed to say, was,
"St. Petersburg."
The other person, interestingly, was Svetlana. Surely after dawn the next morning, on the day of the family's departure, Svetlana appeared in the doorway of the nursery and stood there, blank-faced and still as a post. Penelope was surprised to see her. It was unusual for her to be out of her room herself at that hour, but she had awoken in the dark and could not get back to sleep, and so had decided to tidy that sorry little nursery one last time. "Alas, poor Spud," she had just done intoning, Hamlet-like, to the withered potato, which was now furry with mould. "Into the waste bin with you, for you will soon begin to stink, and I would not leave such an unsavoury item behind for someone else to get rid of. No doubt the task would fall to Svetlana, and surely that poor woman has enough to do as it is." It was at that moment Penelope turned and saw the woman herself, as if her very words had summoned her. She had to blink a few times to make sure the sight was real, such as Hamlet might have done at the sight of his father's ghost appearing on the ramparts of the castle.
"Svetlana, my goodness, you startled me. That is to say, good morning."
She was not sure if Svetlana understood, and she gestured for her to come in. Svetlana did so, and closed the nursery door behind her.
"Spasibo,"
she said grimly. It meant, "Thank you." That much Penelope knew, from her failed attempts to get the children to say it, but what would Svetlana be thanking her for? She followed the woman's gaze to the rotten potato in her own hand. "Ah, I understand. You are thanking me for throwing Planet Spud into the dustbin," she said. "Well, it is no trouble. Dear mouldy old Spud, it was not a very good globe, but it was all the globe we had." Svetlana stepped closer.
"Spasiba,"
she repeated, with feeling. Apparently this had nothing to do with the potato. She glanced furtively at the closed door and lowered her voice.
"Draki."
Dothraki? Penelope repeated, intrigued. There is a card game called Dorak I have sometimes played with the princess. Do you mean that you want to play cards? She put down the potato and mimed shuffling and dealing a hand of cards. Svetlana shook her head.
Dothraki,
she repeated. She sprang into motion and danced comically around the nursery like a broken puppet. It was a surprising show of animation. Whatever she was trying to say must be important. Yes, Penelope replied, nodding. Yes, I remember. Dorak means fool. Dothraki must mean fools. Penelope did an even sillier puppet dance to show she understood.
Dothraki, da.
Now Svetlana pretended to write a letter. With great theatricality, she dropped the imaginary correspondence on the ground. She shivered with pretend cold and wiggled her fingers downward through the air to indicate snow falling. Fully in character, she grabbed Planet Spud from Penelope and held it by its twig.
Barbushkinovs,
she said, and tapped the top of the wrinkled, shrunken potato.
Svetlana,
she said, tapping the bottom. Slowly she rotated the potato, so that what had been on top was underneath, and what was on the bottom was now on top.
Barbushkinovs, nah,
she concluded. She flicked the bottom of the potato with her index finger and a gesture of clear contempt.
Dothraki, da.
Da, Penelope nodded. Da, da, da. Yes, now she gathered Svetlana's meaning quite well. Some day, those on the top of the potato, the selfish landowners, like the Babushkinovs, would be on the bottom. And those currently stuck on the bottom, meaning Svetlana and her fellow serfs, would be on the top. That day had not yet come, but in the meanwhile, Penelope had made Dothraki, that is to say, fools, of their employers by tricking them with that absurd invitation to the capital. And now Svetlana's heart was filled with the bitter joy that only a serf in Plinkst could feel, mixed as it was with misery and resentment, rage and gloom, and an abiding hatred of beets. It was a lot to glean from a round of charades. Then again, Penelope had always excelled at the game. She wanted to show she understood. She rose on tiptoe and performed a single, wobbly pirouette. Then she bowed to Svetlana, reverent and low, as if she were bowing to the Tsarina herself. Like a ray of sunlight breaking through dense fog, Svetlana smiled broadly. Her teeth were excellent, for she had never eaten a piece of candy in her life, and she took Penelope by the shoulders and kissed her on each cheek. Svetlana's face was transformed by the smile, and Penelope realized she was quite a young woman, scarcely older than Penelope herself. It was her grimness that made her seem older. But then the smile faded. Wordlessly, Svetlana left the nursery. She took the Planet Spud with her to toss in the kitchen scraps that were fed to the pigs. Or perhaps she would trim away the rot and make a secret thin soup out of it, one that she would not have to share with anyone. Penelope felt somber after Svetlana was gone. She would have liked to sit for a while, to wonder what might become of the girl, and to wish her well. But there was no time. The sun had risen. The troika would be leaving soon, and she had to pack with care, for she would not be coming back. Before long, the family was up and fighting. When it finally came time to leave, Madame Babushkinov swirled her fur cape to and fro like a matador to coax her three older children to the door. The captain carried the weighty, unhappy baby Max tucked under one arm like a squallowing bedroll.
"Kiss your grandmother goodbye, my dears," Madame said brightly. "After all, she might be dead by the time we get back."
"Dead? Ah!"
The princess had asked to be wheeled out of her room to see the travelers off. Now she endured the indifferent kisses of her grandchildren as if she was being pestered by mosquitoes.
"I do not fear death, but I am in no rush either. Maybe I will live forever, for spite. Ha, ha. Wait.
She clutched one hand with the other and wrestled them together. With all the strength she had, she twisted off one of her large, jeweled rings and offered it to Madame Babushkinov.
Take this with you, the old woman said. My emerald, my favorite, a gift of great value from an admirer long ago. If I die, you can sell, pay for funeral. If I live, too bad. Ah, ha, ha.
The crackling of the princess continued until the travellers were outside. After that, Max's howls of dismay at being left behind drowned out every other sound until the door had been firmly shut behind them. The recent snow had melted, but the air was cold and the ground was slick with mud. A team of porters loaded the Babushkinovs' trunks and luggage onto the troika. Penelope carried only a carpet bag. It held a change of clothes and a flannel nightdress, a pen, and some letter paper, in case a thank-you note or other urgent correspondence was called for, and a papier-mâché seashell the incorrigible children had made during their winter holiday in Brighton. It was her only keepsake of them, and weighed little, and she would not leave it behind.
"And why are we not on our way? The Tsar's own palace could be built in half this time,"
Madame Babushkinov began complaining the moment she was seated, but the troika driver would not be rushed. Patiently he checked all three horses, the fit of their harnesses and the condition of their hooves, before he climbed into his seat and gathered up the reins. He had the grumpy, reticent look of a person who preferred animals to people. Penelope thought of old Timothy and held back a smile. The enigmatic coachman was hardly her favourite person at Ashton Place, but how her heart would have leaped with joy to see him now.
"Hey-ya! Hey-ya!"
the driver called, and they were off. The twins immediately tried to stand and turn around, though they had been told 100 times to stay in their seats.
"Goodbye, house! Goodbye!"
they yelled.
"If we are lucky, Veronica and her smelly toe-shoes will never return. Finally, we can be happy."
At this, Veronica sobbed. The captain growled at the boys and cuffed their heads, while Madame Babushkinov tried to comfort her daughter with promises of new dresses and plots of revenge against her brothers. Penelope did not turn back even once to look at the ramshackle estate, but kept her eyes fixed on the road ahead. Was she giddy with joy to finally bid the barren fields of Plinkst goodbye? One would expect so, but her time in this unhappy town had taught her that it was possible to find the gloom in nearly any situation. "Even to leave a place one dislikes is bittersweet," she thought, "for it reminds us that time gallops in one direction only, and there are places we have been and people we have known that we surely will never see again." But then she caught herself. She sat up straight and took a deep, calming breath. What she needed now was not Plinkstian melancholy, but pluck. Yes, pluck of the most Swanburnian kind. Her plan to get back to Ashton Place and the incorrigible children was in no way foolproof. It would require a great deal of good luck and not one spoonful of bad, and what were the odds of that happening? Only an optimistic, no, optimistic person would have dared take the first step, and now she was on her way at last, but still a very, very, very long way from home. "No hopeless case is truly without hope," she reminded herself, then soothed her nerves by repeating under her breath, "The capital of Russia is St. Petersburg," over and over again. The troika was fast, even in the muck. The drumming of three sets of hooves, along with the ceaseless ringing of the bells that hung from the douga, The part of the harness that arched like a rainbow over the center horse created a hypnotic, complicated rhythm, as if all the poetic meters ever invented were being tapped out at once. It made Penelope drowsy, and when the driver shouted and pulled the troika swiftly and hard to the rutted edge of the road, it startled her into a yelp. She had been dreaming that she was on a train en route to her first job interview.
"Bandits!"
yelled the twins, and readied themselves to fight by punching each other for practice. Bandits! The clip-clop, clip-clop, clip-clop of hooves grew louder by the second. A wagon approached from the other direction. It was pulled by a pair of heavy-boned workhorses with broad chests and sturdy, thick-furred legs that churned like pistons.
"It is not bandits, you ridiculous children,"
Madame Babushkinoff snapped.
"It is the mail sled. Finally, I am glad we are not home to receive any bills and more bills."
Even with the Babushkinovs' troika dragged halfway into the gully at the road's edge, the mail sled came so close that it splattered mud on them as it passed. The sled was piled high with burlap mail bags, all stuffed to bursting.
"The mail sled?" Penelope repeated dumbly. She twisted round to watch the sled continue down the narrow road they had just travelled, gouging a fresh set of tracks in the mud.
"The grocer, the butcher, the man who sells feed for the chickens."
Madame was still going on about the bills.
"Those are the true bandits, demanding our roubles or else.
You are out of credit, they say.
Their nerve. We are the Babushkinovs. Our name ought to be credit enough." "Grocers must eat too, my darling,"
her husband interjected.
"They will get paid when I say so, and not a moment before. As far as I'm concerned, the more they ask, the longer they must wait."
Penelope could not tear her eyes away from the receding sled. There it went, bound for Plinkst, piled high with sacks of mail. Surely one of them held her long-awaited letter from Simon Harley Dickinson. For all she knew, there were dozens of letters in those sacks, from him and the Incorrigibles, and perhaps from Miss Charlotte Mortimer, too. But it was too late to turn back now.
"The mail is so slow,"
the captain observed.
"It is worse than a strike."
"Strike? You mean like this?"
Constantine struck his brother to demonstrate. Calmly, the captain picked up the boy by the back of his coat and moved him, arms flailing, to sit on his mother's other side, uncomfortably squeezed between his parents.
"Forgive me for asking," Penelope said, keeping her voice steady. "But why is the mail so slow?"
"It is the fault of the beats," the captain said. "Blink says no beats. No beats means no rubles. No rubles means no pay for postal workers. No workers means no mail."
"Beats, I curse them, roots and stems and all,"
Madame Babushkinov sneered.
"Beats have been our ruin, Ivan. We never should have left the hat business."
The captain shrugged. It was an argument he had lost long ago. Left without a twin to punch, Boris was forced to pull Veronica's hair to get his parents' attention. She shrieked in outrage, an ear-splitting noise that made the horses' ears pin back and their tails lash. The troika driver grumbled under his breath as he coaxed the nervous animals back onto the road.
"But then, how did Nicky's letter arrive?"
Boris asked.
"Yes, how?"
his brother parroted. Beneath her lap blanket, Penelope's hands curled into fists of fear. On the other hand, this show of logic by the twins was impressive, and she wondered if she had taught them a little something after all. Madame Babushkinoff smacked Boris, then Konstantin, then both boys at once.
"Do you think the Tsar cares about the problems of Blinkst? About our failed crops and lazy postal workers?"
"No. If he wants a letter delivered, you may rest assured it will be delivered no matter what. That is what it means to be the Tsar."
The journey to St. Petersburg was long and dull and cold and wet. The rain mixed with sleet that felt like needles against the skin, and the troika had to go slowly over the muddy roads, which were beginning to freeze. Veronica was so nervous, she could only wring her gloved hands and weep. Boris and Konstantin alternated saying,
"I'm bored,"
and,
"Are we there yet?"
until they forgot whose turn it was to say what, and quit in frustration. For entertainment, they pinched their sister to make her scream, while their parents snarled and blamed each other for things that could not be helped. The poor weather, for example, or the long wait when the troika driver had to stop and have one of the horses reshod. Lips chapped and tempers frayed, and the ceaseless ringing and jingling of the troika bells grew so wearisome, it was like something out of Poe. Fans of gloomy talking birds are already well acquainted with Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, who famously wrote a poem about one. He also wrote a poem about bells, bells and more bells, ringing and clanging and jangling away, from tinkling sleigh bells like those of a troika to the deep basso tolling of funeral bells. That poem, aptly titled The Bells, uses so many different words to describe the sounds made by bells that Mr. Poe evidently ran out and had to invent a new one. Tintin abulation. Tintin abulation. Honestly. As if further proof were needed of the slipperiness of poets. They make up words willy-nilly and have them mean whatever they like. Thank heavens they are licensed and thus kept somewhat in check. If they were not, could full-blown mayhem be far behind? Only Miss Penelope Lumley sat straight-backed and uncomplaining as the time dragged on. She entertained the horrible babushka woos as best she could with stories and games and offered gentle reprimands whenever their behavior grew intolerable. She did all this calmly, without seeming effort, for caring for children in this way was second nature to her and left her mind free to wander. Outwardly, she was steady and efficient. Inside, she was full of secrets. Luckily for her, every few hours, the babushka woos complained and fussed themselves into exhaustion and fell asleep. Only then did she retreat into her own thoughts, and she had a great deal to think about, you may rest assured. However, even for patient Penelope, the journey was a long one, with many hours yet to go before the troika arrived in Moscow, and then an even longer train ride north. It would be 3 full days before they arrived in St. Petersburg. For the moment, then, let us turn our attention back to England, to the grand house known as Ashton Place. That well-tended estate was the very opposite of ramshackle, with no failing crops to be found, only daffodils in bright yellow bloom and the swelling green buds of tulips, full of promise. Yet the mood of the local villagers was not unlike that of the Russian peasantry, for a revolution of sorts was brewing among them.
"Bread! We need bread!" the people cried.
As you surely ought to recall by now, for this fact will soon become quite important to our tale, the village baker had run off to America with fickle, stoop-shouldered Julia, the former baby nurse, and now there was no bread baker for miles. Lord Frederick had placed an advertisement for a baby nurse before the full moon curse had come upon him. But bread baking? That was another barrel of flour altogether. As he said to Mrs. Clark,
"Blast! I don't even know where bread comes from, and why should I? As far as I'm concerned, it ought to grow on breadfruit trees, like they have on those islands in the tropics. Perhaps we ought to plant some, what?"
Lady Constance was no help either, and offhandedly suggested that the kitchen serve gooseberry pie to the villagers instead of bread, and satisfy the people that way. Alas, There were simply not enough gooseberries on hand to make that many pies. It was a pity, too, as Mrs. Clark's gooseberry pie recipe was beyond compare. Poor villagers. To let them eat pie was not an option, yet it seemed they could not go one more day without bread. Mrs. Clark and cook diligently searched for a replacement. They invited bakers from miles around to travel to the bakehouse at Ashton Place and bake samples of their finest loaves. Many came and took up the challenge. These were all experienced and well-qualified bakers, mind you, but for some mysterious